Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,600 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Dr. Kara Zajac, author of The Significance of Curly Hair, a loving memoir of life and loss. Searching through old relics, we found a time capsule in Graham's drawer revealing clues to her dark era, her 1957 breakdown. Dark green pills, a bank book, scribbles on an envelope, answers to unasked questions. She survived stress and abuse without things I take for granted, income, a car, stocked pantry shelves. She did it all with unconditional love, never revealing her pain. Kara Zajac is a freelance writer, chiropractor, mother of a daughter, wife, entrepreneur, musician, and diehard romantic. She received her doctorate of chiropractic degree from Life College of Chiropractic, and for the last 20 years has maintained a private wellness practice where she helps people revitalize their lives by healing the brain and body naturally with chiropractic care, energy work, and brain core neurofeedback therapy. For more information, you can visit her website, which is www.karazajac.com, and that is KaraZajac.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Kara to the show. Good day, Kara.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you, and looking forward to talk about this memoir that you put together. So let's start with, how did the book come about? What was the spark or inspiration for the book?
Well, you know, that is a great question, especially around the holidays when we're thinking of loved ones and we're kind of bringing out old holiday traditions that connect us to our past. My book was actually a deathbed promise that I made to my grandmother that I would tell her story. And the reason it was so important was because when I was 14, she knew I was a writer before I knew. And there was a young boy who had written about his grandfather in the newspaper. And she asked me if I would ever write about her. And in my cocky, young arrogance, I looked at her and I said, "But you've never done anything." And of all the things that I regret, I wish I could take that sentence back. Because I saw the twinkle come out of her eye, you know. We were so close. We were best friends. And I said something so insensitive to her. I couldn't understand, you know, that even though she didn't have a college degree, she didn't have a big career, she taught her children and her grandchildren about love and about empathy and about how to overcome strife and such huge things. And unfortunately, I couldn't understand that until I was old enough, and she was actually passing away. So she was in a coma, and I got to talk to her on the phone. They said she could hear. And I said, "Grandma, I'm writing your book. I'm flying home right now. I want you to know that I started it." And her heart rate went from 68 to 72, and then she died. Yeah, she died about 5 minutes after that. But she heard that, you know, hopefully I'm making it up to her.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure she's guiding you from wherever she is right now.
I believe she is, because there were some stories I got to put in there, and I was like, how did I know that? Yeah.
Yeah, I am sure. So, you know, tell us about your grandmother. Kind of like, what was her essence about?
She had this remarkable way of, I know people say, you know, turning lemons into lemonade, but she just really had this remarkable way of looking at life and being able to overcome stress and just kind of go around it and say, hey, you know, it's going to be okay. And I think I think that was because in 1957, she had a nervous breakdown. My grandfather died and left her with four kids under the age of 11 with no money and no car, and she had no job, and it was the 50s, and she was a house, and it was just, like, so stressful that shifted something in her. Like, from then on, she was like, you know what? Nothing could possibly be as stressful as that. And, you know, her and I slept in the same bed until I was 9, so we were, like, really close. And I think having that magical part about her really rubbed off on me as a person. And, you know, I mean, because you can always look at things. You can look at how stressful things are, and, you know, even with, like, politics and everything, oh, it's so bad, and have, like, a doom and gloom. Or you can be like, yeah, you know, people have gotten through this before, and just kind of find a different way out. And she just had this magical way of doing things like that.
Yeah, that's a beautiful approach to life that she gave you.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, the more I think, you know, I have a daughter now, and now she's 15, but as I was raising her, I think of the way I was raised by my parents and my grandmother. And if there was a lack of money, per se, like, okay, I wanted to get something and I didn't think we had money, she would say, you know, I'm just going to go downstairs and pick some money off the money tree. And she would say it so, just in such a way that it was believable. You wouldn't even doubt it. She just, you know, of course we have a money tree downstairs. Yes, you know, and Grant said it. And she would just come up with this stuff just, like, on the whim, you know. And so it's cool stuff that I hope that I've been able to do with my daughter as well. But just a personality like I've never met before. Very, very inspirational, very, very loving, very encompassing. And I think it's important as people, as families, as friends, that we remember how to treat each other like that, especially in a world that's so divided nowadays, you know. So it's nice to have that encompassing kind of love.
Exactly, exactly. So now, when it comes to writing and publishing a book, an author usually takes great care in selecting its title. So what is the significance of curly hair?
Oh, that is the best question ever. Okay, so my grandmother had this thin, fine, flat hair, and she always hated it. She was born in 1913, so she... Around that time, everyone got permanents or did pin curls or rollers, and curly hair was just the rave back then. And she always wanted curly hair. And she met my grandfather after World War II, and he had curly hair, and he could dance, and he was an artist. So she fell in love with him, thinking that their offspring would all have curly hair. Well, it's obviously a recessive gene, because their four daughters all had very fine, straight hair. But the grandchildren got the curly hair. So whenever I would do my hair when Gran was alive, she would just come, oh, your hair is so beautiful. It's so perfect, you know, and just make this big thing about it. And that is the significance of curly hair, because I got the family gem of hand-me-down DNA.
I love that. Yeah, I too have curly hair. So that was when I first received the information about your book, I thought, boy, this ought to be interesting. So,
yeah. Well, and you know, the book isn't completely about curly hair, but it was so important to her. And I feel like as people with curly hair, we're in this, like, this kind of invisible club where, like, I don't know about you, but, like, people will just come up to me, strangers, and, like, start touching my hair and talking about how great it is. And it's really funny how something you think is so insignificant, but it's something that someone else wants, you know?
Oh, it is. And I know every time I went to get my hair cut, the cutter would always say, you don't know how much people would pay to have that kind of hair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah. It's funny like that. You know, there are some days where, you know, it rains here and I look like a stupid Muppet. I'm just like, wow. But then other days I'm like, oh, this is kind of nice, you know.
That's okay. I agree.
Yeah.
Now, I understand. I'm sorry. I understand that your mother was your grandmother's caretaker and constant companion over the last 35 years of her life. So how did your mom react to your mother's passing? Because I know being a caretaker can sometimes work into being a full-time job.
Yes, and that's exactly what happened. So my grandmother had her four daughters, and my mom was the youngest of the four daughters. And when she got married at 21 years old. Gram was very lonely, and within, I think, 2 or 3 months, she had moved into their apartment because they were about to have me. And she's like, well, I'll just sleep on your couch, and I'll watch the baby if it's a good baby. And so she started out sleeping on my parents' couch when they were only in their early 20s. And then as they moved into a house, she kind of moved with them and then just lived with my parents the rest of her life. So her and my mom were really, really close, and their lives were very intertwined, almost even, you know, codependent.
Mm-hmm.
So when my grandmother died, it was sudden, like she fell down the stairs and ended up hemorrhaging. So it was very traumatic. My mother saw it. She held a lot of emotion in. She felt guilty because she thought, I'm always here to catch her, and the one time I didn't catch her. It was hard to watch that pain in my mom. There's a scene in the book where she has kind of a breakdown because she's trying to wash the clothes with the blood stains on it, and I suggest that we throw them away, and she's like, no, I can't. This is what she wore every day. And there was so much closeness there that it was hard to separate. But fortunately, she has moved down south, closer to us. So she's about 10 minutes down the road, her and my dad. And she has been very active in our daughter's life. So I think that just having that turnaround and being able to look forward to something new and a new life, and maybe being able to fill that role that Gran had with me, now she has with my daughter, I think that has been very healing for her.
Supporting the next generation is a wonderful way to look forward rather than backward.
Yeah. But she did get stuck on that grief and that guilt of not catching my grandmother for a long time, almost in an unhealthy way. I was like, you know, Mom, it was her time to go, you know.
Right.
I don't think it would have mattered, you know.
It can be that guilt can sometimes hang on, you know, but it's really important to remember that, you know, when someone's time is up, it's up, no matter, you know, what the circumstances are, you know. And
sure.
and it was, you know, it's a shame that, you know, she had to be there, you know, when it happened, and the, you know, the idea of not wanting to discard clothing, you know, that's the idea of trying to hang on to, you know, what once was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you know, it is hard because, I mean, my grandmother was 94, so she didn't know. It got robbed of life. She had a very full life, but she was so good that we weren't ready to let her go. And we probably never would have been ready to let her go. That's how good she was, you know, and being able to get your hands around that and be like, wow, that's a life well lived, you know?
It is. And, you know, I can understand about your mother, the idea of, in a way, holding on to the circumstances around your grandmother's fall. Just recently, in July, my life partner of 37 years passed away. And you know, it was one of those cases where, you know, he was a very spiritual person, so you're fully aware of energy goes on, you know, that kind of thing. But quite often my mind will replay those final moments. And, And it's a tough thing to process and to work through in that time period.
For sure. I'm sure it is. That's 37 years, that's a long time.
Yes, it is. So you indicate in the book that while searching through old family photos, you discovered disturbing truths hidden away in old boxes. Now, one of them, I understand, is the 1957 breakdown, but what other things did you discover, and how did you feel when you learned something that you hadn't known and that was something tucked away?
So after my grandma, we all knew she had a nervous breakdown, but she never talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
She never talked about the pain of it or the suffering or what really happened, you know, when she was stuck at home with four young kids and no money and just her body just stopped, you know. So we would all guess, you know, well, I imagine it happened like this, but I mean, really, how did they buy food with no money coming in? How it, and we could never really connect the dots. So my cousin brought over a drawer from a chest of drawers that had been in somebody's garage, and come to find out it was Graham's chest of drawers from that time, from 1957.
Wow.
And going through it, we found, like, she never even took an aspirin. She was, like, super healthy. She didn't have, like, arthritis. She didn't have blood pressure issues, nothing like that. So not on any meds at 94 years old. And we first pull out this prescription bottle of these heavy green pills. And in this shaky script, it says nerve pills on there. And I don't remember the exact name of the pills right now, but when I looked it up, it was like a class 4 narcotic.
And Oh my,
probably knocked her out, you know, the nerve pills of what they gave a housewife in 1957. And then, you know, my family was Catholic, so they had 5 children in 6 years and didn't use contraception. And my grandfather died of a heart attack, so he had heart issues. He wasn't really supposed to be having sexual activity. So we found, like, a diaphragm and spermicidal jelly, and which was shocking to find because, you know, there were very strict rules back then. So she was going behind my grandfather's back to try to prevent more stress. And then finally, you know, when we're just like, wow, you know, we found an envelope with, she had tallied up her bills. And I think, like, at that time, it totaled up to be about $12, which in 1957 was a lot of money, especially if you weren't bringing in any money. And, you know, it'd say, like, milkman, 32 cents, and dance lessons, and my Aunt Nancy's asthma medicine. And just seeing, like, what she had to work with was really, like, wow, like, I spend more than that at Starbucks on a daily basis, you know, and that's what she had for a whole month with 4 kids.
Wow.
Really eye-opening. And then finally, we found a bank book that showed that our Aunt Dorothy was kind of putting money in her bank, and that was the source of the money tree. And just learning that, it just warmed my heart. Because, you know, we're going through this drawer and it's just so much pain and so much misery and so much hardship. And it's like, God, how much can one person take? And then we found the bank book, and it just, I don't know, it just answered all these family questions and made you realize that, you know, love is out there. And when there is a will, there is a way. And, you know, God provides, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really commendable that she was able to still maintain that lightness, you know, the idea of a money tree, and just having gone through all that heartache and challenges, and yet still become an inspiration.
Yeah. And, you know, she really was. I think the stress of that time was just so much that she was just like, you know, I'm never going to deal with that again. I'm never going to let anything weigh me down, because what could possibly be more stressful than that? And it really changed her mindset. And in a different way, she passed that on to us to how to kind of look at things differently and just always go through the, you know, the lighter point and seeing if you can make it work that way, which has been really a great life lesson. Yes, she was very, very inspirational. And, you know, her biggest fear was being forgotten. And in this way, I just want her to know that there's no way she could ever be forgotten. It's impossible because she had left such a mark on so many people. And now through this book, you know, I'm getting to share her story with the whole world, you know, so more people can learn. Yeah, and it's just, it feels good.
Yeah, and it's important to recognize that everyone has a story and everyone's presence on this earth is very important and can influence others around them. And to just keep that in mind when dealing with people, you know, and recognizing there may be some things that they are going through. They may not show you, but there may be things that are going through that are challenging, and being a friendly face or a supportive type of person can go a long way in helping those.
That is so true. That is so true. You know, a lot of times we don't talk about painful things and we don't talk about stuff that hurts or stuff that's uncomfortable or stuff that might be embarrassing. And I think when we share stories, especially through reading, because it's kind of private, there's a different kind of connection that we get. And we realize, you know, we might all be very different people, but as humans, we have a certain level of connectedness that, you know, there's similarities that we cross paths. And it's very true, like you were saying, you know, you don't know what someone else is going through and you don't know what is going to give them that helping hand that might pull them through a tough time.
Absolutely. There is a portion in the book that talks about an adopted cousin who discussed the adverse effects of prejudice and the varying degrees of separation caused by racial tension growing up Black in a primarily white town in suburban Boston. So can you tell us about that cousin, and were you aware of the prejudice and separation feeling?
So, you know, to me, he was always my cousin. He was like 18 years younger than me, so we didn't grow up at the same time. But no, not until the funeral did I realize. I mean, I knew that, you know, I think I remember my aunt mentioning some things, but I don't think I really knew the depth of it until the receiving line in the funeral afterwards. He told me, you know, everybody here knows that I'm Nan's son, but if they just saw me, they wouldn't think I was because my skin has a different color.
Yeah.
And it struck me in such a way because I was like, that's something I've never had to deal with or even think of or wouldn't have even thought of, you know, because to me, he's my cousin. It doesn't matter what he looks like. Of course, we love him and you know, but to him, that's how he feels. And it broke my heart for him.
Yeah.
And it made me want to just wrap him up and up, you know, and I think that racial tension that's out there, when we can see how someone else is feeling, then it gives us more empathy, you know, and we can kind of look into their eyes a little bit and say, well, how can I change this? And sometimes we can't change it, but sometimes we can, you know.
And
what I said to him, I said, you know, I know we look different, but you had the curly hair that Graham always wanted. Like Graham always wanted, you know, and my wife, Kim, is blonde haired and blue eyed, and she looks more Swedish than the whole rest of the family, you know, so maybe it doesn't really matter as much how we look, but what's in our hearts, you know, and what we live, you know, and Yeah, and he was about 13 at the time. I don't know. Maybe that resonated with him. I hope it did. You know.
Yeah, exactly.
Eye-opening experience for me, for sure.
I am sure. Also, since you mentioned your wife, Kim, after a week of being with the people that you love most during that time period, you pushed aside your fears of having a baby in a lesbian relationship, realizing that raising a child with Graham's values and morals of love would be far more beneficial than limitations set by religious virtues. That one struck me because in the gay community, first of all, many times people don't expect you to be a parent, you know, and often, you know, there are challenges that go along with that kind of situation. So tell us about, you know, obviously you have a daughter, you know, who's, you said, I think 15, you said?
Yeah.
So tell us about, you know, that moment of, you know, that aha moment that you had realizing that you had a lot to offer as a parent.
Okay. So that happened during the week of my grandmother's funeral. I didn't realize it at the time, but I felt like I was living my life opposite of hers because I felt like she had been held down by men and all she got to do was raise kids and she didn't get to go out and explore the world and reach her dreams. And she never told me that. I just thought that, you know. And I was like young and gay and I was gonna move away from our town and do my stuff and play music and no one was going to hold me down, you know. And then she died, and this enormous blanket of grief just was like, oh my God, my best friend is gone. And it really opened my eyes the week of the funeral as to like the deep connections that we pass down from generation to generation through families, through friends, through stories, through important acts. And even though I was a girl that never really, I wasn't young and I didn't say, oh, I want to have six kids or whatever. I wasn't one of those girls. I was going to go do my own stuff. But then during that week, I realized, you know what? Why wouldn't I want to pass down Graham's personality, Graham's gifts, Graham's love, her empathy to the next generation? Why wouldn't I want to do that? If the only people out there having children are the ones that don't want them, well, we can't have that. We need some good ones out there, you know? And it just really made me think that, wow, kids need love, you know? Not necessarily a nuclear family or a mom and a dad or two moms or two dads or whatever, but they need parents that love them. They need people that will show them how to be good and show them that, hey, you know, you matter and you're important. And treating other people nicely matters, and it's important. And so that's kind of how Kim and I, you know, came. Well, Kim was always there. It just took me a longer time to get there.
It can take, you know, it can take some life experience and shift in perspective to get to that point.
And so we live in a small town in North Georgia, which, you know, is very much the Bible Belt in Georgia. And I was concerned about, you know, two women having a baby in the North Georgia mountains. But I'll tell you what, you know, we thought about moving to the city. There's a city close to Atlanta called Decatur that's a very gay friendly city. But I was like, you know, if we all move to the place where everyone is and then leave the other places out, then how does change happen if nobody changes?
Yeah.
So we decided to stay in this small town, and in my practice, my chiropractic practice in Dawsonville, Georgia, I'm very open. You know, if people ask me about my marriage, you know, I'll say that I'm married to a woman and we have a daughter, and you might know our daughter in school. And I have been surprised at how much love and support and acceptance we have gotten. You know, people appreciate honesty, and I think they realize that our family is really not that different from their family, you know. Yeah. And it's really been wonderful.
Yeah. I live in South Carolina, so I know the whole Bible Belt issue here. And it was funny with some of my friends who, when I lived in California, were like, what the heck are you doing there? You know, and the energy is so dense and so judgmental. So what are you doing there? And I basically said, well, you know, in order to bring, you kind of need to bring light into the darkness, you know, that I will be there, you know, I will be myself. And, you know, hopefully there will be people who may not have encountered, you know, a gay person before and will think twice about some of their preconceived ideas.
That's very true. That's very true. And you know, I think also when they meet us first as people,
mm-hmm.
and then realize after, you know, oh, you're also a like I don't introduce myself as like, hey, I'm Kara the lesbian. I'm Kara the writer or Kara the mom or Kara the chiropractor or the musician. And oh yeah, besides that too, I'm a lesbian and we have a daughter. And but you know, once they get to know me,
right.
It shakes some of that other stuff off, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's what growing is. And I'll tell you what, in this small town in North Georgia, it's been very charming, and we are very glad we stayed.
Great. Now, people grieve differently, and I believe you indicated that writing this book was cathartic for you. Is that true?
Oh, it was very cathartic. You know, I had to fly home to Boston. My mom called me when Graham had fallen, and she's like, you need to come home right now. She's not going to make it through the night. So I jumped on a plane, and because it was last minute, I couldn't get a direct flight. And so I was on the plane, and I brought my journal with me. And up till that point, I was like a terrible writer, not terrible, but just kind of, I was a crappy writer. And there was something about that grief that it just like busted open this wall inside of me. And I just started writing well, like writing something that someone would want to read. That was, you know, a promise. I just started writing. And I think having that outlet to be able to move that sorrow and move that feeling of loss, the feeling like she's floating down the river and I can't catch her. There she goes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about writing it on paper to get it out. So, yes, it was very cathartic. And I think by the end of the story, I had a different peace with her passing, you know.
Yeah.
It was very helpful for me. And many people who have read the book have said, you know, it helped me grieve, or it helped me kind of complete my grieving, or just reminded me of things, you know, that I had forgotten about. And you know, thanks for writing that, because it was very helpful. So that's kind of always good to hear, too.
Yeah. You know, I was going to say, it's for people who are going through the grieving process to be able to read and connect with someone who is going through the same kind of process, it's encouraging to recognize that, first of all, it's okay to grieve, and it's important to get through the process. And there's also light at the end of the tunnel of the grief.
Yeah, and sometimes that's the hardest part to get to. It's like, where do you find the light, you know? And
mm-hmm.
It's not like there's a handbook that says, well, this is how you should do it.
Right.
This is the best way. Try this, you know, and it's probably not the same for everybody either, I imagine, you know, but sometimes when we can connect with someone else's journey and, yeah, that makes sense, and then maybe that will kind of kickstart your journey, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So now, other than sharing the story of your Graham, what do you hope people will take away from reading The Significance of Curly Hair?
I hope they take away from it that, you know, we all come from different places. We all come from different nationalities and genders and orientations and religions and whatever. But even though we're all different, you know, there are some core things in between all of us as humans that really, really connect us on a deep level. And I always want people to feel more connected to each other rather than distanced, you know, and I feel like that's one of my kind of deep passionate goals, you know, is help someone through a tough time, lend out a hand, grab a hand, hey, come on, let's go, you know, because we're all kind of in it together, you know, and that's kind of one of my core things. So that's what I would like people to take from that.
Yeah, we know in this world, separation is abundant. You know, we even though we communicate with others like through social media, quite often that person-to-person talking, interacting, a lot of times that's missing. But that carries such value that we sometimes need to really give attention to.
It sure does. It sure does. And you know, I think that it's so easy to forget because, you know, we have these phones that have everything on it. And sometimes you go out to dinner and you see these families sitting at a table and they're all on their phones doing their own thing. And it does. It distances us from the person sitting right next to each other, you know. And I don't know. Like, Graham wasn't like that, you know. She wanted eye contact. We would sit at the kitchen table and have some warm raisin toast, and it's like we could work out the world's problems with raisin toast and just sitting there talking about it, you know.
That's crazy. Well, Kara, thank you for your time today. I really enjoyed speaking with you, and it's wonderful that you're able to share your Graham's story through your book.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you, and if anyone wants the story, it is available on Amazon, and it's now on Audible.
Oh, very good, very good. So again, everyone, today my special guest has been Dr. Kara Zajac, author of The Significance of Curly Hair, A Loving Memoir of Life and Loss. And again, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is www.karazajac.com, and that's KarazaJac.com. And in closing, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.